move through the other remaining agenda items. We will open a subcommittee, public testimony on action item number 10, which is a construction contractors board of report on technology plan.
Clarification, Mr. Chair, this isn't an action item. You're simply receiving a report. I mean, it's not action.
As I said, it's bullet item number 10.
Thank you.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair, the construction contractors board is before you today, as directed by budget notes that the 2001 legislature placed in the agency's budget, having to do with moving its web server or website to DAS IRMD facilities. Also directing IRMD to conduct an annual review of the progress being made by the Construction Contractors Board toward goals of its technology plan and defining what the plan review should include. And it's also directed the CCB to update its technology plan with the assistance and approval of DAS IRMD. And in all of these, it was intended that the work of the developing and implementing the technology plan include the participation of legislative fiscal office, and that has occurred. And with that, I would have the agency speak.
Senator Atkins and co-chair Representative Butler, my name is Craig Smith. I'm administrator of the Construction Contractors Board. I'm joined to my right by David Shepard, who is our information technology manager. In the room with me is our IRMD analyst, Sean McSpaden. As staff has indicated, we are here to report to you in accordance with the three budget notes. First, CCB was directed to move its public web server to IRMD. We have completed this task with the exception of the CCB contractor inquiry component and are prepared to do that as soon as they are prepared to receive it. Secondly, CCB was directed to report jointly with DOTS the progress we've made towards completion of goals contained in our technology plan. We have worked closely with Mr. McSpaden in preparing that report. We detail that progress in the written material before you, and I believe Sean's prepared to offer verbal comment if you so desire.
Keep going.
Lastly, CCB was directed to update its technology plan with the assistance of DOTS. We have done that. Pursuant to a budget note, CCB established an IT steering committee. This committee has worked to update the technology plan. A draft of that plan is included in the written materials before you. As a living document, that version of the plan continues to evolve and will become final next week when the board reviews it, modifies it if necessary, and votes upon it. Due to several factors, the agency is experiencing approximately 26% decrease in projected revenue. For this reason, we are not seeking additional spending authority to update aging computer workstations. Instead, we spent approximately $50 per station to improve the RAM on those machines, and they work adequately.
Good.
That concludes my report. I'm here for questions.
How big is that board?
The approximately 70 employees, 60 to 70 employees. We have some contract people as well. We license 42,000 contractors.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Chair, this came through the committee that I served on in the Ways and Means process during the regular session, and I do recall some of the concerns which we had relative to the presentation of the CCB. I'd like to just follow up. With a 26% decrease in the revenue, my recollection was that you didn't have a large amount of free board to be. We had more than enough to go through a standard work plan. Do we have any feel for where this leaves the CCB right now, so far as their regular revenues are concerned? I assume this is probably a temporary decline based upon the current economy.
Representative Butler, we believe that's correct. We think there's several factors. We hope that it's temporary. Our high point was approximately 46,000 licensees. We're down to 42. We are seeing an increase in licensees. We believe it will pick up. We're operating off of our using up some of our cash reserves at this point, and we're not in trouble at this point.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I just just really want to caution any of these agencies during these difficult times that they need to make the necessary. They can't continue a status quo any more than other agencies can. They're generally funded agencies, even though they're using other funds, which in this case happen to be the members and subscribers to the CCB license holders and so forth. So this is the first of these outside agencies that we've heard today, and I'm hopeful that they are taking the steps necessary to tighten their belts internally, because that's something that they, with their boards, would direct them to do. I know that there is probably an increase in the proliferation of non-licensed folks. We've had some communications, Mr. Smith and myself, just recently over that. I'm hopeful that we'll be able to get the necessary number of investigators, private investigators out there in the field to keep an eye on that sort of thing happening, so that we can protect the consumers in Oregon as well as those who go about becoming contractors the right way and subscribing to the all the principles of the laws. So in that regard, I appreciate the assurance that Mr. Smith gives us that even with a 26% decline in CCB revenue right now, that they're still able to make the necessary adjustments internally. They can continue forward and maintain the necessary cash reserves to stay out of trouble.
Do you have any testimony to add, or?
Nope.
Okay. Anything further? Thank you very much.
Thanks, sir.
Close the public testimony. We'll move to action item, bullet item number 13. Open a public hearing on Department of Human Services report on technology and reorg efforts. Hi. Hi.
Yeah.
Would you like to give us an introduction on this one?
Certainly. This is an introductory report, if you will, from the Department of Human Services to talk about what's happening on technology projects to help implement the service integration that the department is undergoing. The last legislature, of course, approved House Bill 2294, which was the DHS reorganization bill, to achieve the goals of that reorganization in terms of program and administrative simplification and consolidation. There is a technology piece. Those elements were not well defined, and we knew coming into this that there would need to be additional work on that. There was money earmarked for that out of the projected savings from the reorganization, and so the department's here today to bring us up to speed on what they have done thus far and what their plans are.
Well, good afternoon. My name is John Cuddy. I'm the Chief Information Officer for the Department of Human Services. From an IT standpoint, the reorganization of the department has caused us a basic problem, and that is that we have a whole bunch of information systems that have been developed over the last 30 years that are in stovepipes, to use a current piece of jargon, that were developed according to federal funding streams and the needs of individual divisions. And those divisions have now been rearranged and merged and so on. And our information systems still follow the old model. And it will be a massive effort to try to rearrange those to comply with the new model. And basically, the data in those old systems was not integrated. It was developed, again, according to those old stovepipes. The programs needed data for their programs. The formats are not consistent. The definitions of data are not consistent. There's questions about what's a case, who's a client, that are addressed differently in different systems. The department's reorganization really calls for a much different way to look at data, and that is that with an integrated field structure where the department is now working to collaborate and coordinate on the delivery of services, to do common case planning and things like that, we need data now that crosses traditional program lines. And we need to be able to bring as much information as we can about an individual or about a case, no matter what program they're being served by, together into the same place. And the systems that we have today don't do that. And so we have been wrestling with this problem for a couple of years. It started out really with the Department Service Integration efforts around the state, the most notable one being in White City in Jackson County, where we worked to try to figure out how we could make cross-program data available to people working in that office who were trying to deliver services in a more integrated way. And now with the reorganization of the department, that really has now become a need that is statewide. And I think the other thing I'd say sort of as an aside, that there's, I think, a common agreement that if this reorganization is ultimately going to work as intended, that information technology is going to be a key, if not the key enabler, to allow that to happen. And so we're under a lot of pressure, and there's an urgent need out in, particularly in the combined integrated field structure now, for information that starts to allow people to look across programs and look at information related to individual clients, no matter what program they're served by. And so we've really done a couple of things here. We have embarked on a group of what I call sort of near-term tactical support things we can do to support the transformation of the department. And those are things like trying to make information available from different programs on one PC. And we've been using a product called MetaFrame to try to allow a worker to have on their same desktop PC information from the child welfare system and information from the food stamp system or what have you. But that really doesn't integrate the data. All it allows them to do is flip back and forth between those applications and those systems that are still in those old stovepipes and see what's there. And we've done some other things along those lines to try to give them some interim, as I said, sort of short-term tactical kinds of things. What we've been wrestling with is trying to figure out how to support this thing in a more strategic way long-term, because really, the department has now changed the way it's doing business, and we need to create systems long-term that support that new way of delivering services. And we went through a number of activities over the last couple of years, went to some national conferences, put together a report just about almost a year ago that looked at the four prototype counties for service integration and tried to put together their business needs around service integration. We had last summer a group of vendors make presentations to us about what they could offer in the way of services, systems from other states that we could bring in, tools and things like that. And one of the things that we identify that is really unique is that there exists a thing called a human services framework. And basically this framework, which is named CURAM, C-U-R-A-M, is produced by a company in Dublin, Ireland. And CURAM is an Irish word meaning care and protection, I think it is. And what you normally think about information systems or about many things, you have a basic decision made as to whether you're going to buy something or whether you're going to build something. So you have sort of a buy or build decision that you often get into. And the people who have produced this product have a way that they say that I think is instructive, and that is they say that what they have is buy and build, not buy or build. And so what you get with this framework is a basic set of applications that are fairly generic but which do a lot of things, and then you are able to take that's the buy part, and then you are able to take that and add in your unique business needs to tailor it and make it fit what we're doing here in Oregon. And it's intentionally not meant to be complete to allow that to happen. The state of New Mexico has been using this product for about a year, and the first thing they did was they worked to replace their food stamp system. And they took, from the time they started until the time they went into pilot, it took them about 6 months which is pretty astounding for those of us who have some familiarity with food stamp systems. They estimated that it would be up to 24 months to do it if they had done it under normal techniques for system development. Part of the reason they were able to do that is because of the buy and build thing, and what happened is about 80% of what they put into their new system was part of the buy. That was part of the standard stuff they got with the product. And about 20% they had to spend putting in their own unique business needs for New Mexico. And I'm not saying, wouldn't say to you that if we did that for our systems across the department that that same percentage would necessarily hold. It could vary depending on what we're trying to do, but there are opportunities with this thing to get significant increases in time and potentially significant savings in effort to start bringing these things under this one common framework. And what you get with the buy part of this is, and actually what you create, is a set of software building blocks, many of which can be reused. The term for them is objects. And so this thing is somewhere between purchasing or transferring a solution from another state and building something from scratch. And so when you create these building blocks that you can reuse, it then enables you to do a couple of things. First of all, if you can reuse them for your own system, you're saving effort. And we've now got six states that are interested in this product that are working together. And we've been had at least some preliminary conversations about trying to perhaps share those building blocks across states. For instance, New Mexico, when they did their food stamp system, which is a system that is the food stamp benefit is 100% federal, and the feds pay a major part of the administration of the food stamp program. There's a big piece of food stamps that is the same for every state in the country because it's dictated by the feds. And so what New Mexico did is they kept their food stamps objects separate from their New Mexico objects, and what they have basically said, if and when we or any of the other states that are trying to work together to see what we can do with this are ready to replace our food stamp system, they would give us the food stamp, the federal objects, and save us having to create those, which are the same, would be the same for all of us. So we think the thing has an awful lot of potential for us. Another thing that it does is it has a single data model. This thing is aimed at human services, this particular framework. It has a single data model that covers everything in human services. So what we would be able to do as we started to bring our systems under this and redo them in this framework is we would then start to create that common data that is missing from our stovepipe systems today. And we're pretty excited about the potential that that has to really support the integration of the data that needs to mirror the integration of the department's service delivery. Another thing that it does is it will allow us to interfaces that we believe with our existing system, so we'll be able to sort of operate it at the same time that we operate our existing systems, which will allow us over time, and it will be a considerable amount of time, to start bringing a number of our existing systems under this.
I know, Mr. Chair, can I ask a question of John? John, is the current system can it be purchased in modules, the food stamp module, for instance?
No.
All or nothing at all?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, yeah, you buy the whole thing, and you don't actually get a food stamp module. What you get is things that are more general, like case management, a financial module they have and stuff like that, which is more generic, that you then add your own piece onto.
If I may ask, which was the module that, or the portion of the program that New Mexico had converted to adapt this base program for food stamps?
I don't know specifically. I think it was pieces of a number of the things that they get that they put together.
And the total cost of the current package?
Not sure yet. It is resold by various bidders, and we would ask for bid prices on it. I mean, a rough guess for the entire department, $10 to $15 million.
So does New Mexico pay? Do we know?
No. Do you know, Robert? I think New Mexico has spent about $10 million for services and licenses for the product. We're still in the very preliminary stages and don't really have that stuff pinned down yet. Another thing that it does is it is heavily web-oriented, and so it will allow us to use web technologies as we start to move into that realm. And I listened on the television to the conversation you had this morning with Representative Hill, and this fits very much into what DAS is proposing to do with their e-government infrastructure. One analogy that we were talking about walking over here is that what Representative Hill talked about is they're going to supply a house. And what this does is this allows us to define what we're going to do inside that house. We're all going to walk through the same doors and we're all going to look out the same windows. But this is the business layer as opposed to the infrastructure layer that Jim Hill talked about earlier today. So
this will match in with web
very much
spheres as the house.
Yes, very much.
That program.
It's very compatible with the products that he talked about, WebSphere, DB2, and those kinds of things. So yes, it's very compatible with that. Now, we don't have all the details, obviously, figured out with them. But this would be us doing the business part that he mentioned this morning as opposed to the infrastructure part, which they would do.
That brings up a good question. On his presentation, which I think Representative Butler and I are the only ones that have it, one of us, he talked about some of the three largest data collection points for government are DHS, ODOT, and DAS. Now, I guess, we hear ODOT and DAS are building their internal house, to follow that metaphor even further. Is there any ability to cross-share between from your agency over with some of these modules, wall structures, from those?
Mr. Chair, it's probably too soon to say. One of the things that we've discussed with John Latimer and some of the DAS people is the possibility. This thing, for instance, is heavily oriented toward what the Oregon Employment Department does. In fact, the New York Department of Labor has this product and is using it to redo, and that's equivalent to our Employment Department. I think there may be some potential over time for this thing to be used by some other agencies in Oregon government. But again, remember, it's heavily oriented toward human services. I mean, it was built specifically for human services. And in fact, the United Kingdom has just signed a contract with EDS to replace their human services system for the country. They got like 1,500 offices and 70 million people. And they're going to use this product for that.
Your protocols, I mean, the protocols that you're going to set up inside of these modules are going to match with the protocols, with the overall protocols of WebSphere.
Yes.
E-government.
Yes.
One of the fears that I think is expressed often by this committee is that we'll move towards e-government. We'll have protocols that set up on this global, again, to say WebSphere's. But then all the underpinnings under that, we constantly are going to have to change or update. It won't be fluid. Once it's connected, we're afraid it won't be fluid.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense. But you're saying that this we're going to build over time and update over time.
This is really different from what DAS is doing. I mean, we would want to use browser technology internally for our applications, and then when we go outside and either clients or partners or whatever would come in to use this, they would presumably come through the Department of Administrative Services portal. So they would get to us sitting behind that. But we would be building this certainly in technologies that are compatible with that. But I'm not real sure that we need, I don't know whether we need that compatibility quite to the degree that you just expressed it, as long as we're compatible and stuff runs through them to get to our business applications, which is really what this is. Just the finally, I know that time is short here. We are embarking on, basically what we have said is this thing is so strategically important to us that we really need to check it out thoroughly and kick the tires pretty hard. And so we are embarking on a six-month prototype, proof of concept, whatever term you want to use, to really check this thing out here in Oregon. And so we have just, in fact, this week started a six-month activity to actually try this product out and see how the ability to interface with our systems works, to see how easy it is to build those rules for our business needs that are unique to Oregon, see how easy it is to integrate that with the modules that come with it and connect that together and so on. And so what we're going to do is work on this thing and try it out for 6 months, no long-term commitment, again, just part of our continuing investigation of whether this makes sense for us. And then we're going to, after that, make some sort of a decision about whether to proceed or not, and the intention at that point would be to come back to the committee and talk to you about what our six-month prototype field test and so on has shown us, and then talk to you about where we think we'd like to go in the future and what we think it's going to cost and some of that stuff. We'll have a lot more of those specifics roughly 6 months from now figured out, and then we'd want to have a what I hope would be an interesting conversation with you all about that.
Mr. Chair, any other states other than New Mexico having success with the Curum product?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, New York, I hear likes it a lot. They have just started a prototype similar to ours here, I think about 3 weeks ago in Louisiana. So it's starting to grow, and as I said, there's six states that are seriously interested in it that we're working with, among them New Mexico and Louisiana and some others. But it's currently in being used now by two states that have bought it and another one that's looking at it as we are. And then, of course, I mentioned the UK and Singapore just signed a contract with it to do it. I'm told every house in Singapore has Ethernet. So it's a little different environment from what we're used to. But
any follow-up, Mr. Chair? Any indication that the federal government, because as you had indicated in your opening statements, that much of the human services functions were driven by originally the Department of Human Services in the United States. Any indication that perhaps we'll have some participation from the federal government and the migration as we feed back information? They may be able to provide grants and other subsidies for the acquisition of Curum?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, that currently is not a real good story to tell there. They are in worse stovepipes than we've been. And those federal programs don't talk to each other very well. In fact, some of the other states have had some conversations with their federal regional people, and basically the federal regional people have said to them, yeah, gee, we're not sure we know how to do a horizontal system like you're proposing. In fact, I just got an email from a person I know in Kansas this morning who said they were having problems with the feds on these kind of integrated systems. So one of the things we've done along that line is there's an organization in Washington called the American Public Human Services Association. It used to be the American Public Welfare Association, and their executive director was out here about a month ago. He went to Medford with Bob Mink and looked at Jackson County and at White City and so on. And we had a meeting with him about this very topic, and he and I, coincidentally, when he was the number two in Texas Human Services here until last year, had co-authored a paper for the General Accounting Office about these kinds of problems with getting the feds to improve their approval processes. And so he is very interested in this and has said that he'd really like to take this up from a D.C. perspective and want some states to work with him to try to get the feds to do some of exactly what you're talking about. But I have to say, in all honesty, at this point, we've not gotten, not so much we in Oregon, but other states, have not gotten a lot of good signals out of the feds yet, but we're working that.
Mr. Chair, I just make comment on behalf of the committee. I guess it's very concerning when we have problems at the state level, but I guess I should say, why am I not surprised that they've got problems at the federal level, too? So they've built themselves into the corner just similar to what we have. I guess all this time I feared that was the case, but hope that somebody would come to our salvation on a white horse, but
not yet.
It looks like it's going to happen. Thank you.
Thank you. I think what we'll do is we will close this action item and have you just sit right there.
Yep.
And we will open another action item number 14, report on Medicaid Management Information System.
Again, for the record, I think Hirsch Crawford is going to join me. Again, for the record, I'm John Cuddy, the CIO of DHS. And we've been coming to report to you frequently about this project, which is a multi-year, multi-biennium project. And we are back again. We were here last time in September. And I think we can start, right? Are you or am I? Should I just?
I think you were.
Okay, well, I'll do it. The bottom line is that I have the same report that I gave you in September, which is that this project is still on schedule and on budget. And we are now at the stage where we are looking at alternatives for how we might build, acquire, go outside for whatever a new Medicaid management information system. And we have a number of options along that line. We can outsource this activity and have somebody run something for us for a fee. We can try to transfer an existing system in from another state and perhaps modify it to meet our business needs. And we have finished the work to define our business needs, our so-called requirements. And we're now sort of saying, okay, how might we make these requirements real in the form of a system? Another option would be to build something internally when this thing is so massive and complicated. Frankly, I think that's an unlikely option. One of the things that has come up since this project was originally conceived and since we last talked to you is the possibility of using Curum for at least some of it. One of the big advantages that Curum would give us is because of this integrated data model that I mentioned a few minutes ago, if we were to take our client data and the stuff around clients, for instance, and I'm not saying we're going to get to go to this, this is just the thing we're thinking about at this point, if we were to take our information around clients and put it into that Curum common data model, we would then be able to integrate that data across a bunch of other programs in the department that would help potentially with service delivery and with planning for setting of policies and program planning. So we've added another wrinkle into this, which is to take a look at whether Curum would make some sense for this thing and whether it might save us ultimately some time and maybe even some money. Not sure yet about that. The one thing I would say to you is that if we decide that Curum is something that is valuable here, we would probably make a conscious decision to delay this thing for some period of time until we get familiar enough with Curum, finish our prototype, decide if Curum makes sense, probably implement something else first. I have to tell you that it would be high risk to take something this complex and this big and this mission critical and immediately right out of the chute start using Curum to try to do it. But we think Curum has enough potential for us that we're right now looking at what role it might play in this thing. And as I said, if it turns out that it we think it could play a significant role for us, we might end up making a conscious decision to wait a bit so we could use Curum in a less risky way. But otherwise, the project as currently constituted and defined is, as I said, on schedule and on budget. And speaking of budget, I want to point out that there was an error in the numbers in your letter, and I think, I don't know if you want to feel as
I have the corrected numbers. The letter did make it look like when the federal approval was received on the project that the total project cost went down, and that was not the case. The general fund piece went down. So in the last budget rebalance plan, the department had a $1.5 million general fund savings because of how the budget was actually approved by the feds. But the corrected numbers now are about $2 million general fund and $16.1 million federal funds, so that the total project is still about an $18 million project. So there hasn't been any scaling back at this point of the total scope of the project. It's just that the funding mix, as approved, has changed to our advantage, and we took the $1.5 million general fund savings already.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Thank you. I'm looking to the federal system under the Medicaid Management Information System. These folks probably demand of us as a state that we provide them certainly probably just a one-page report in effect to say here's what you gave us and here's what we did with it. I'm sure it's a whole lot more than one page.
Yes, it certainly is.
You boil the whole thing down, that's basically what they want to know. But in that process, they've got to have some audit trails. And so they come to 50 states and how many territories, and they say, we don't care what system you use, we're going to have auditors that are going to just have to learn your audit trail system. They don't have anything to accommodate some degree of uniformity amongst the coming out from the federal government. I'm certain that they would have the protocol and the guidelines for mandatory maintenance of audit trails and those kinds of things, but I find it almost incredible that the amount of money that the federal government puts into the Medicaid system that passed out to the states for administration and management, that they don't have, certainly you look at the report and it says you've done good, you've done bad with the money, but the bottom line I guess I'm looking at is they've got to audit this, and in that process of the audit, do they just depend upon the independent audits or the Secretary of State's audits of the 50 states plus territories?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I think there are a couple of different things. I'm sorry, for the record, I'm Hirsch Crawford, the Administrator of the Office of Medical Assistance Programs. I think there are a couple of different things here. I think directly on point to your question is, yes, they do, in fact, depend upon the Secretary of State's audits in every state to determine whether or not funds are being spent appropriately in each state's Medicaid program. In addition to that, as John indicated, we have a number of federal reports that we submit monthly and quarterly and annually that explain to the feds how we spent the federal share of the money. And then there are federal auditors from Region 10 who are here virtually every month looking at something. But in terms specifically of MMIS and the requirements around that, there are certain, they're fairly general requirements in the sense that every state's MMIS has to have certain subsystems and be able to do certain things. And within the requirement to meet those standards, you do have some flexibility then in how you want to do it. And so the process that we're going through now is the process of deciding what exactly do we need our system to do in order to meet our business needs and how do we want to design that. As John said, at this point, we know what we have reached agreement on what we want it to do, and we're looking at four different models for how that might be accomplished. And then once we, based upon the recommendation of our outside contractor, decide which one of those models is the most appropriate, we will then come back to you with a proposal for moving forward with phase three of the project, which would be actually issuing an RFP and acquiring a contractor to implement the system.
Mr. Chair, I feel it's almost incredible that you get as many systems out there, and obviously when you go to the national programs that you go to or the technical programs that deal with the information technology, I'm sure there's a lot of vendors there. But the bottom line is that the federal government just says as long as you got all of these bells and whistles, we don't care what you do. And I guess we can go and look at your budget, look at your dues statement, and see how much we're paying for dues for the various organizations that we belong to, as the Department of Human Services and the various programs that are involved here. And I'm saying those folks should have been providing us with a lot more proactive solutions prior to this time than when we find ourselves unable to migrate to the next stage. And maybe we can migrate, and the best thing to migrate through to is the CIRM system. I don't know.
Mr. Chair, I think the comment that John made is very appropriate. I mean, that may in fact be a solution which is gets us a tremendous amount of flexibility in terms of what we're able to do with it. But it is also probably the most high-risk approach at this point, because you're beginning from scratch and you're taking a technology which at this point has never been used to build an MMIS. And as John said, it's a mission-critical component for us. We run 1.5 million claims a month through this thing, and it's got to work, and it's got to work all the time. So there are some advantages, but there certainly are some concerns that we would like to have a chance to accurately assess before we come back to you with a recommendation.
I think it's commendable, Mr. Chair, that the department is taking a go slow attitude to make certain that there isn't any interruption of the benefits or the human service needs. Thank you.
Any further discussion? I apologize. For those of you who weren't here this morning, we have one member that went to a task force, a couple that are missing, one who's sick, one that's going to go vote in rules, but I'm going to wait a little bit longer until they come grab me. But we're proceeding. We're actually gaining ground here. So we will close the public testimony on that action item, and you're still there. We'll open a action item number, or bullet item number 15, public testimony on Department of Human Services report on mental health payment system.
And again,
one more time,
hopefully the last today. For your record, I'm John Cuddy, the Chief Information Officer of DHS. Jack Morgan will introduce himself, but he works in our seniors and persons with disabilities cluster, one of the newly formed groups from our reorganization, and is really responsible for the business side of what we're trying to do with this project. So we thought we'd start out and have him remind the committee for just a couple of minutes about sort of what we're trying to do here and why.
Great. Mr. Chairman, the system that's being proposed here is one that would replace...
State your name for the record.
I'm sorry. I'm Jack Morgan. I work with the seniors and people with disabilities. Previously worked with the mental health and developmental disabled services division, which operates a payment system with counties. And this system provided payments through county governments for mental health services, alcohol and drug services, and developmental disability services. And that's the program that's being proposed for replacement. It's a system that really operates off two different databases. The first is one called CPMS. It's the client process monitoring system. And there is an adjunct system which runs on our base. The client process monitoring system was built in 1979, and it was not built as a payment system. It was built as a client tracking system. And in 81, it was converted to a payment system because the state had an opportunity to collect federal dollars under a Medicaid waiver program. So the system was redesigned so it could operate as a payment system. The RBASE system was added sometime later, and what it does is link the payments to our contracts, budget, and accounting systems. In total, the system is very old, and it operates very slowly. It is long needed replacement. The reconciliations of payments take about 3 months. There is also a reconciliation at the end of the biennium, which can take an excessively long period of time. Providers complained for a long time that payments were not being made promptly, and they had a lot of difficulty trying to deal with and understand the reports that came out. The situation became more acute with the Staley lawsuit settlement, which is expected to increase the caseload in developmental disabilities by around 30% over a 6-year period. So it was really out of that latest change that more impetus was put on developing a payment system. Some startup funds out of the settlement agreement were allocated for development of a business requirements plan that covered all three of the program areas.
What I'd like to do is talk to you for a couple of minutes about the project. We first step of this thing was to put together our business requirements, and that work was completed by a contractor on schedule in November. The next steps were to hire a project manager and some technical people to actually do the work. We have had major problems getting people hired. We went out twice to get a project manager, and in fact have just hired somebody finally after months and months of going out and going back out again. The person just started this week. We've tried to get our lead technical person. These are limited duration positions, and the longer we get in, the farther we get into the biennium, the tougher it is to get people to take short-term positions. We've been out three times to get our lead technical person and still have not found anybody suitable. What we're doing is a couple of things, as I mentioned, and we're kind of in now, how do we get out of this bind stage? Doing a couple of things, as I mentioned, we have just hired our project manager. We're going to take another look at the scope and at those requirements and try to get done between now and the end of the biennium the really high priority requirements so we can give them something to help them get out of this looming bind that Jack mentioned. And the other thing we're looking at is, instead of hiring, whether we can try to quickly get some contracting done to get some of the technical staff in to work on this thing. That's the not good news, delay and because of not being able to find people. The slightly good news is we have given the federal government a final draft of the paperwork we need to get them to agree that this is a 90% or approximately 90%. We always go through that on this. More or less 90% federal money project. And we've given them the final draft, and they've given us verbal approval that they're going to fund this at that level, which is good news as far as the impact on the state general fund. So that's kind of where we are. As I said, we got our requirements done on schedule, and we've had trouble getting people, and just this week I've got a project manager started and are going to be looking at some of the things we can do to sort of fall back and regroup and see what we can get done here by the end of the biennium to meet some of Jack's critical business needs.
Senator Butler?
I don't have anything. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I don't either. John, though, if I talk to you on the side of the room on another related matter,
sure.
Real quick.
Yes.
I think what we'll do is we will thank you very much for coming. We'll close that action item and open action item number 11, Public Testimony Department Administrative Services Report on Current IT Projects. I'm going to leave you by yourself. Yeah, I would, but
no, I appreciate it.
I just asked Joan to try and call her Sam Hansen. There's no answer
here. If I'm going up in the elevator, he's asleep.
If you want to get us started and present, that would be great.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we're at the point in the agenda where we, Department of Administrative Services reviews current IT projects that it's monitoring through quality assurance reports and other things. I'd like to point out that after Carl does his presentation, he'll introduce the IRMD person responsible for coordinating, I believe, the state efforts for the HIPAA. H-I-P-A-A is the federally mandated
weight loss program.
Something like that, yes.
My wife is on that.
Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Carl Weineke, the state's quality assurance manager. I'm here to report to you on the state's large information systems projects. We're currently monitoring 20 projects within the state, which have a total of $124.4 million. Two projects since the last reporting have closed, and the report that you have before you contains the lessons learned from those reports. They are report order number 6, which is the Department of Human Services Transition Referral and Client Self-Sufficiency Project, which was called the TRACS Project. And the other report is from the Department of Administrative Services, which was the State of Oregon Enterprise Network. That project has closed some time back, but we're just getting the lessons learned report included in our report to you. Two new projects have also started within the period, and are the early preliminary information is contained in your report. It's report order number 18, which is the Department of Administrative Services, and it's IRMD's Remedy Operational Service System Project. And in addition, there's a report order number 19, which is the Liquor Control Commission's document management system. At this time, I'm happy to report to the committee that there are no projects in serious jeopardy. However, in the next 3 months, I will be monitoring the activities on the Department of Education's TESA project. That project has got three areas that have drawn my attention to it, none of which are serious at this point, but I want to get more information on this. And I think the bulk of the issue has been as a result of funding problems and a slowing of the project, which has caused them to miss some of the dates. So hopefully, I already know that they've made great progress since I wrote this report, so I'm not at all worried about that one. The report format is also unchanged from prior reports. However, I have made one slight change to it. I've asked a lot of the quality assurance organizations to start giving us an overall project assessment. And when those assessments are available, the summary report, which is the colored report that you have, will reflect the overall project status. And so I'll be working on that in the time to come, and trying to refine that even further. So I don't want to cause false alarm on a project, but I also want to give the committee the major risk, which will also be part of that. That really concludes my report for you today. I'll be glad to entertain any questions you have on any of the projects that we're currently monitoring.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Butler.
So with the additions of numbers 18 and 19, including the OLCC, looks like the total of the projects is down under 20 projects that are open right now. Is that right,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler? That is correct. Although I suspect that there may be some new ones opening up, but we've been staying right at that 20 to 24 mark for as long as I've been doing this.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I really like this report. I haven't had a chance to really study it, but I like that it says start date, end date, and where it is on the priority. That
gives you some ascertainable standards under which you start to run into problems with your costs and your deliverables.
I really like that. Senator Butler, anything else for this?
No.
That was great. Thank you.
Commander,
Mr. Carl. Chairman,
yes, sir.
Members of the committee, I'd like to introduce
member
to
the, of the committee.
Member of the committee. Subcommittee. I'd like to ask Barb Jensen from our section to join me. Barb is the HIPAA coordinator. She's here to give some testimony and a report to you on the status of her effort.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and member of the committee. My name is Barbara Jensen. I'm the project administrator for the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. This was enacted back in 1996, and we wanted to take an opportunity to introduce to you the statewide effort that's underway that complements what DHS has already moved ahead and done, just like in many other states. What you have in front of you is a fact sheet that we've put together that we will be preparing and giving to audiences. It will evolve over time as we make progress in what the state is doing. I'd like to offer just a few minutes on the background, a little bit about who's affected, what the state of Oregon is doing, and what the next steps would be. HIPAA is intended to protect health insurance coverage for American workers and their families when they lose or change jobs. That's the core part of HIPAA. HIPAA has five titles to it in the Act. The second title is called Administration Simplification. In that title is the State of Oregon's effort, and that is to help change technology systems as well as policies and practices the way we handle our medical data in confidentiality. This is very, very wide-ranging. It's across the nation in terms of getting something done on this, and many of the DHS organizations, such as our DHS, have taken a lead in this area. There are pieces in which we need to standardize our technology systems. Having been involved in the Y2K effort, we used to classify that effort as a 40-60, meaning we had 40% technical changes and remediation, 60% policy practices and businesses. In HIPAA, we look at a 30-70. So it's a little more intensive on the policy and practices because behaviors themselves will need to be changed. Who's affected? As I indicated, DHS has moved ahead. There may be other programs in our state agencies that could be classified as providers, plans, or payers that include medical data that would come under the 1,000 federal pages of legislation in HIPAA. There are penalties involved for not meeting HIPAA standards if, in fact, that enforcement comes to Oregon or goes to any state, and those range anywhere from a few hundred dollars up to $250,000, as well as imprisonment if we are caught in a violation that is excessive.
Mr. Chair, is that as to the state's violation of the HIPAA? Or is this against private employers that do not adhere to the? Are private employers, they are covered under HIPAA where they have to allow that portability and accountability?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair, member of the committee, that is true. This is wide sweeping in terms of both private and public sectors, and very focused on health insurance information.
And finally, in that regard. The violations, are there existing violations frequently within the state of Oregon amongst the private industries in Oregon relative to HIPAA violations?
Mr. Chair, member of the committee, not that I'm aware of. HIPAA is now just moving into that phase in which we need to make sure that we're compliant. The deadlines will start occurring about a year from now, and there'll be probably three consecutive deadlines over the next couple of years that we'll need to meet.
And will we be required as a state to monitor private employment, private employers, in that process? And how do we do that? What this has got a terrible aspect of Big Brother written all over it. I need to have some assurance that we're not going to be out beating employers up in the state of Oregon because we think that they ought to be giving coverage to somebody if somebody comes from large employer X and happens to have an opportunity to go to a three-employee shop where they don't have any health insurance benefits, they pay their money and takes the chances? Is that what we're saying?
Mr. Chair, member of the committee, this is a responsibility of each provider, each payer, and each plan. So those enforcement penalties will be between the federal government and the entity. And we have our own requirements under that plan, but we will not be an enforcement arm of that plan.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to state publicly that I'm very concerned about the state getting involved in the enforcement of a federal action. I think that there's lots of snake holes out there that we could fall into if we start to kind of be the state enforcer of a federal law.
Mr. Chair, member of the committee, that's absolutely true, and in fact we have partnered with risk management in many of the DAS divisions to make sure that we're walking this path carefully and that liabilities are assessed, and that when we deliver the assessment tool to state agencies next week, they'll walk through a 21-page assessment tool that basically, takes them through a path and says, here are the risks and liabilities. We are doing a due diligence documentation effort just like we did in Y2K, and we're very careful about that liability line.
And finally, is this a federally funded mandate?
Mr. Chair, member of the committee, in part it is. Some of the funding that will come through DHS is in different phases going to be different percentages. In part, they'll get up to 90%. In some parts, they'll get 50%. So so there will be federal funding. There is also the idea that if we don't meet the regulations by the federal government, that it can put in jeopardy the $3.3 billion of Medicaid funding that DHS receives currently. So we don't want any of that to occur in the business of Oregon.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to go out on the limb here and just tell you where I come from in regard to that. When the federal government starts passing laws that they expect us to pay 10% of the enforcement, then they're going to hold over our head the $3.5 billion as to whether or not we get the opportunity to go ahead and administer all of those state or those federal Medicaid programs on behalf of the or for the benefit of the state government. I sometimes look at that and say, you know what? We could go ahead and just have the federal government come in and take care of their own Medicaid programs for all of it, you know, because what happens is that, yes, they do benefit some of our Oregonians and a lot of our Oregonians and our constituents, but turn the programs back to the federal government. I don't know whether any states do that, but when they pass that stuff back down to us and they expect us to come up with it out of our general funds, which are, you know, we're not passing any tax cuts right now in the state of Oregon, new tax cuts. The federal government is doing that because they have the ability, uniquely, to be able to go out and print money. And we don't, you know, last I checked, we didn't have that. Would you check on that for me, please, Gal? Okay. I don't think we have that opportunity in the state of Oregon. Maybe some bum script or something like that. But they have the ability to go ahead and do a lot of that where we don't. So I look at that and say, well, we're going to lose some of those federal funds that they let us use to administer their federal programs, and Jiminy, that would be terrible if that happened. I said, at some point, maybe we just let them administer their own programs.
Can you forecast if HIPAA today is going to be the HIPAA in 18 months?
Mr. Chair, member of the committee, the answer to that, the simple one, is no. This is a regulation that has yet to be finalized in totality, and it continues to evolve. I did want to share with the committee that in an all-state comparison where we're looking at other states, we have found that we're middle of the road. Many are behind us. Many have no website presence, no coordination effort. Some have a little bit of taste in their DHS environments, but they're all struggling with the money. At the head of the pack is California, Colorado, who actually enacted legislation. California identified $94 million, and we don't know the status of that 94. In fact, I talked to them this morning, so we're still struggling with that. But in wrapping up what we're doing and making sure that we've embraced this effort on a statewide level, because there are programs within state government that can be identified that may not be DHS connected. So we want to make sure we're covering the liability track, as you talked about, as well as helping our agency. It is the responsibility of all of our agencies to become HIPAA compliant if they have rules, if they have programs under those rules. So I just wanted to make you aware of that, and that DHS has been working on this since 1999, and we've made some real headway. We're also very closely partnered with Department of Justice, and Don Arnold is our sponsor over there. We're working closely, and they have developed some expertise in-house that's going to be very valuable to our agencies as we walk through this arena.
Where is Wisconsin in all this mix?
Well, that's an interesting one, and in fact, I can share the all-state review with you, Senator Atkinson, at the break if you'd like. I can't remember whether... I think we have the chart.
It would be interesting to know where Tommy Thompson...
I don't think it's going to be the same in 18 months. I mean, I share Representative Co-Chair Butler's heartburn with regards to federal matching, a little bit of enforcement, a little bit of work on our end with big matching dollars, because that little bit of money usually costs us a lot of money. I mean, it's a tactic used by the federal government quite often, but I really don't think that the 1986 version of HIPAA is what we're going to have in a couple of years. I'm optimistic.
Mr. Chair, Senator Atkinson, what we have on our cursory review is that Wisconsin had a presence in their DHS. We have not identified a statewide presence, but we'd be certainly willing to follow up on that. One other point of clarification, just so you're aware, is that we're really the communication catalyst for the agencies. Different than in Y2K, where we monitor their compliance directly, this will not be a direct monitoring of compliance. We will give them tools, templates, aids, help them understand the rules as much as we know, but it is their responsibility to become compliant.
Well, I guess we'll go down this adventure and see where we end up.
Senator, I think between you and I, we could probably clean this thing up if they just give us the keys to the kingdom for a few days.
A few hours with your calculator.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Don't we have the...
Oh, yeah. But that action item?
Yes.
All right. We will close that action item. We're almost there. The three... Let the record show that I got up at 3:30 to drive up here, and I'm here. And Representative Butler is from another time zone, and we're still here. Or whatever the records were. We will open the last action item.
You may not be able to communicate in complete sentences, but...
Mr. Chair, no number?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is the request of the Oregon Telecommunications Coordinating Council, which is a council that was established in statute this last legislative session, and we have with us some members of the council, along with Bill Penholm from the Association of Oregon Counties. They'd like to give a status report because they're required by law, if they come up with any legislation or the like, to submit it to the legislature through this committee. So, with that.
Go ahead and introduce yourselves.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Bill Penhollow, representing the Association of Oregon Counties, and Representative Butler. Recognizing that it is now almost 3:30 in your time zone, we will be brief and take that into consideration, and the fact that the good chair got up at 3 a.m. this morning, and no one should be traveling that early in the morning. With me today on my immediate right is John Irwin, who is the chair of the Oregon Telecommunications Coordinating Council, and to my far right is Brant Wolf, who is the co-chair of the Oregon Telecommunications Coordinating Council. As you may recall, this council was established by Senate Bill 765 in the last session. It has had four meetings thus far, presented you a written report at the last meeting, and we thank you for the opportunity of coming today and just providing you another written report on progress that's being made, but also appreciate the opportunity to have Chair Irwin make a few comments about the progress of the council.
Good afternoon, Chairman Atkinson and Representative Butler. I'm John Irwin. I chair the Oregon Telecommunications Coordinating Council, and I, too, are from Southern Oregon.
They told me I could call you and get a ride this morning. I think I'd be here a little sooner.
We may still need to look into that at some point in the future. I will be mercifully brief in our report at this time. I also represent, on the council, I am from the Southern Oregon Telecommunications and Technology Council, which is an organization in Southern Oregon. In our first report, we described to you the initial steps for forming the council and setting our direction. Since the last report, council has gotten down to some substantive tasks. I'm going to make this very brief for you. The council certainly recognizes that its work must be fairly wide-ranging, as indeed are the issues that we're facing, and addressing the issues that are emerging in telecommunications these days. Faced with such a large task and a limited amount of time to facilitate these recommendations, we're moving forward on as many areas as we can. We're taking seriously the mandate to study the issues and to create recommendations out of that. We are currently well underway in that process with a significant amount of work remaining. We're getting really excellent cooperation from a wide variety of parties. I'd like to comment, too, that the council itself is made up of quite a wide range of interests and parties from both industry and from our rural areas and from government and so on. Really, what we want to do is to create for you recommendations that reflect sound, balanced, thoughtful input into legislative process. And we look forward to participating further on this. And that's really about all I was going to talk to today, but I am, of course, open to any questions that Chair and Committee Member Butler may have for me.
Grant, would you like to?
I had no comments, Bill. Just here to answer questions.
Well, I actually, when I look at page 3 of the handout, and I see what Co-Chair Butler and I both come from a part of Oregon that we don't exactly have duplicity in telecom all the time. And especially with how it relates to internet access or broadband or whatever term we use at the time, is that that changes actually weekly. And oftentimes in some of the rural areas, in the most rural areas that I represent, there's been a big push by local cities or the city to create an enterprise zone, attract new businesses, but then new businesses get interested, look forward to ramping up, but then can't get there because there's no duplicity. For instance, Cave Junction is one of those places that has a great opportunity to locate businesses there, but they, you know, they're dial-up. No one's going to locate if they're still on dial-up. And I would suggest probably very similar. Do you still represent Lakeview?
No, Lake County was moved over to District 53.
In his former district, I have some experience, and I know that was the case there. I think that part of that was fixed. But notwithstanding, on page 3, you've got cable television providers, Charter, and then some internet service providers. One of the things that I'm really interested in is how do you build two things? One, duplicity, and secondly, speed in rural Oregon. Speed will do two things. Speed attracts business, and speed also helps education products that we have. For instance, whether or not it's a community college in eastern Oregon or where we live, in southern Oregon, or if it's kids doing research or businesses are locating. As you go down this road, those are the topics that I know I'm very particular and interested in.
Yeah. Yes, Senator Atkinson, Chairman Atkinson, and Representative Butler. I do a lot of work working in rural communities and participated in the creation of the strategic plan for Josephine County. I'm currently working with Douglas County and currently working with Klamath County to create strategic plans in that area. Just last week, we launched an initiative in Josephine County to create a digital village. What we're finding is that we have to work closely with the communities as well as telecommunication providers to help folks understand what the demand is in a particular area, to help build that business case. And one of the issues we have in dealing with the telecommunications providers is this helping them to understand what aggregated demand is in a particular area to build that business case, because bottom line is they have to have one. So we have a responsibility, I believe, in our communities to work together to help understand what that demand level is. One of the initiatives that we're looking at under the council's auspices is having to do with education of communities, particularly in this area. How can we help communities understand what it is, what steps they need to do to take to work within their own communities and to also work with providers and other entities to help them build that profile of their area and advertise that. You also addressed another matter, and that is route redundancy, a very serious issue, as a matter of fact, not just because my telephone call might get interrupted or my business might get interrupted, but we also now have issues coming up around homeland security that are going to be very important to consider in this realm. Yesterday, maybe before yesterday, I can't remember which, there was another major fiber cut in eastern Oregon. Unfortunately, it took down the east of the Cascades, a great deal of east of the Cascades, because somebody was dragging a backhoe through their backyard. Happens all the time. Just so happens that in just a very few months, because of the what happened under SB 622 and the investment that Quest has made of their monies into route redundancy, that this will not be a problem in, say, just even 2 or 3 months. There are still large areas of the state where we do not have sufficient route redundancy in place, and this, once again, also is a financial issue that we are going to have to understand. How can we help incent, or how can we help build and demonstrate the demand in these areas? A big piece of this is not just getting the infrastructure in place, but it's also helping folks understand how to go about facilitating getting that in place, and then also how to take advantage of it once it's there. In a lot of areas, what we're finding is when these advanced services are provisioned, the demand pull or take rate, depending on whether you use FCC jargon or PUC jargon, those rates are very low. And a lot of times that is a result of folks just not understanding how to take advantage of these advanced services. So right along with, as we are building infrastructure, we need to help people understand how to use it and take advantage of it. And I think that may almost be as an important fact as building the infrastructure itself. Just throwing the technology over the transom is not going to solve the problems. I work with a lot of small communities in terms of economic and development and quality of life improvements. And time again, what we find out is that they just don't know what to do with this stuff or how to get there. So we need to help them do that. I hope I've answered your question.
Yeah, it's kind of a rambling question on my end, but...
Honestly.
Talked a lot about here, at least during my time in the building.
We've got some interesting issues to wrestle with here, folks. This issue of public-private partnershiping is one that we're just now starting to embark on. Mm-hmm. And it's not without issues. And we're going to wrestle those down and see what we can come up with in the way of recommendations to address that. I'm actually really looking forward to this coming from a... I'm a capitalist, coming from that orientation. And how are we going to crack this nut? Because we certainly, every day when I'm out working in these smaller communities, I see the opportunities for improving economic life, quality of life, things like telehealth, telemedicine, education. All of these things are right now dragging down our rural neighborhoods and folks out there, and we've got to do something about it.
Thank you. Let's play a futurist game for just a moment. What's it look like in the future for Oregon's rural communities, rural America? Are we always going to be dependent upon, you know, when that particular cable company allows us to have a pop on that fiber, or are we really looking beyond that to the time when this we'll be utilizing satellite technology and everybody will have uplinks galore? How long into the future are we? We're burying a lot of fiber and burying a lot of money in that process, and then we're finding there's huge amounts of dark fiber that just probably will never be used because of technology. And so I just like to know that you folks are looking down the road far enough when this nation won't be hooked together with the kinds of cables that we've been reliant upon all this time.
Chairman Atkinson, Representative Butler, I wish I had a crystal ball. One of the things that I do know, I've been in technology for over 25 years, and I was listening to some of my brethren back here talking to things that you probably may consider mind-numbing at some point, but I was excited about because it's good to hear things moving forward. And indeed, that's what's happening with this industry. Every day, there's something new emerging. One of the temptations is to use the past to predict the future. And this is, I'm afraid, one of those arenas where we can't do that, where it's going to require some no-box thinking. And by that I mean that just thinking out of the box, that there's a tendency to leave stuff behind. There's stuff we want to carry along with us in the way of ideas. But as we look into the future, we really are going to have to open up our minds to new ways of doing business, new ways of creating partnerships, new ways of financing things. There is no cookie-cutter approach for this right now. In many ways, Oregon is on the leading edge of this. Some states may have taken some steps in other directions and may be a little bit ahead or whatever. But Oregon is very much at the forefront of this. In this report that we passed out, there's a paragraph that cites results of a recent study from the NTIA. Oregon is ranked fifth among 50 states in internet use. And that's with dial-up. Just think what we can do for our citizens if we help provision them with advanced connectivity. And it's more than just getting on the internet. It also has to do with transferring data, big chunks of data like x-rays, computed x-ray tomography, CT scans. These are just mind-blowing chunks of data that get blown through pipes. Most of our pipes can't currently handle that. But we will see our mixed modal solutions, because we're not going to be able to put glass everywhere. That's the best solution, really. But it's just not feasible because of the location, terrain, and so on and so forth. If we can crack it here, crack this nut in Oregon, we will be a model, because we have every imaginable terrain, every imaginable obstacle, every imaginable barrier, distance. I mean, I'm pretty excited about the work that's being done in this state and really pleased to be a part of it.
Looks like you got good help, too, on either side of
it. Let me tell you, they're both here to prop me up today. This is my first adventure into public service of any nature, and to be nominated as chair of this council and now paraded before you is a little bit unnerving, but we'll get over that and move forward.
We're breaking you easy with only yeah. three of us.
I often get this response, to tell you the truth.
Well, you're obviously a very intelligent man, because you're surrounding yourself with great help.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, and that concludes.
Thank you, members.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We will close that public testimony and adjourn the committee.
Go take a nap.